You want life to mean something, and you want it to hurt when someone dies, and you want to feel the loss of their life. You know, sometimes you do just want to chop someone's head off at the beginning, but I'm really so character driven in the way I write, and everything sort of falls around the character. And so, yes, it kills me to have to kill some of these characters. And I always remember sort of mourning it as I'm writing it. But it's also, I think, just elevates the book because it elevates the losses.
It's Shelf Life. On this episode, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, as we follow the clues into twisting novels of detection. One is Agatha Christie's 1924 novel, The Man in the Brown Suit. The other is Graham Greene's crackling espionage thriller, The Ministry of Fear. What did those two writers teach my guest, the writer Christopher Bolan? Find out after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Authorities in Rhode Island say they've detained a person of interest in a mass shooting at Brown University yesterday. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports the attack left at least two people dead and nine injured.
Providence Mayor Brett Smiley announced Sunday morning that a person of interest was in custody, but police didn't share any details about the man. Smiley said the shooting, which occurred at a Brown University building where final exams were taking place, came as a shock to the city.
I think maybe intellectually we knew it could happen anywhere, including here, but that's not the same as it happening in our community.
Brown University President Christina Paxson said Saturday evening that at least 10 of the 11 victims were students. The Ivy League school canceled exams after the shooting, and authorities said Sunday morning they had lifted the shelter-in-place order for the campus. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
At least 12 people were killed in a mass shooting at Sydney's Bondi Beach today. Authorities say 29 others were injured during a Jewish holiday event marking Hanukkah. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the attack was targeted.
An act of evil anti-Semitism, terrorism, that has struck the heart of our nation. An attack on Jewish Australians is an attack on every Australian. And every Australian tonight will be, like me, devastated.
Today's attack is Australia's first deadly mass shooting since 2022, when six people, including two police officers, were killed during a suspected ambush. The UN Secretary General condemned the attack as a deadly assault on Jewish families. The President of Israel is urging the Australian government to act against what he describes as a growing wave of anti-Semitism. The Palestinian militant group Hamas says one of its senior military leaders has been killed. The Israeli military says it carried out a strike Saturday on a vehicle west of Gaza City, killing the man. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports from Tel Aviv.
Hamas chief Khalil al-Hayya announced that Commander Ra'ed Saad, who Israel considers the second in command of the group's military arm, was killed by an Israeli strike. He confirmed the news in a speech marking the 38th anniversary of the group's formation. Al-Hayya used the speech to outline what he called the accomplishments of the October 7th, 2023 attacks. He called them a form of resistance that restored the Palestinian cause and said it was a source of hope for Arabs and an example of how to confront occupation. The attacks killed around 1,200 people in Israel, according to the Israeli government. It triggered a war in Gaza that has killed more than 70,000 Palestinians, according to local health officials. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News in Washington. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the federal criminal trial begins Monday for a county judge accused of helping a man evade immigration authorities when they showed up at her courtroom to arrest him. Mayon Silver from member station WUWM reports the case has become a flashpoint in the Trump administration's mass deportation efforts.
Judge Hannah Dugan has pleaded not guilty to federal charges of obstructing a proceeding and concealing an individual to prevent arrest. Former prosecutor and Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson says a big issue for the jury will be Dugan's mindset on April 18th when ICE agents showed up at her courtroom.
Whether she was trying to impede and obstruct a proceeding or whether she was trying to do what she thought was her job, run her courtroom, deal with her cases, and try to keep from having the Department of Homeland Security interfere with that.
Prosecutors will likely argue Dugin tried to impede ICE agents from making an arrest. While the defense is expected to make the case, she was trying to follow court protocol in uncharted waters. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Milwaukee.
Torrential rain from a powerful atmospheric river is causing historic flooding across parts of the Pacific Northwest. The governor of Washington State has declared a state of emergency, and the National Guard has been deployed to assist with rescue and response efforts. Floodwaters are now starting to recede, but officials warn of more rain and the risk of mudslides and infrastructure damage. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
Hello. On this episode of Shelf Life, intrigue and suspense in London during the Blitz, courtesy of Graham Greene's 1943 espionage thriller, The Ministry of Fear. And we head to South Africa with a motley crew of shifty characters in The Man in the Brown Suit, an early novel by the world's best-selling novelist, 2 billion books and counting, Agatha Christie. Here to tell us why these books mean so much to him is the author Christopher Bolan, who has established his own reputation, in the words of The Guardian, for classy page-turners, cat-and-mouse games riddled with booby traps. His latest is The Lost Americans, his fifth novel. He has said, the whodunit is a lost art. It's all police procedurals now, and it's never really a surprise who does it in the end. Occasionally, there's a good twist, but for the most part, it's simply a number of steps they take. That can be interesting, but it's not what I wanted to do. Christopher Bolan, welcome to Shelf Life.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I quoted you there in a 2015 interview with The Rumpus, describing the whodunit as a lost art, one you were certainly playing a part in keeping alive. Perhaps a good place to start is to describe what elevates a good whodunit from the crowd.
Well, you know, I think that there's so much extra pressure on mystery writers. I mean, a lot of people degrade the mystery as a sort of a weaker genre to literary fiction. And I've thought so much about this. I've had so many arguments with myself in the shower about this subject. And I really think that one of the difficulties of writing a really brilliant whodunit, and it's very obvious because it's in the question whodunit, is that literary novels, if that is a genre to itself, tend to peter out at the end. They just sort of dissolve into sort of bits of paper in water. And that's okay. They're allowed to sort of remain completely mysterious to the end. And a lot of them just fall apart. But you have this intense pressure on an ending with a whodunit. And you really have to land, you have to start strong and you have to end strong. And that's something that a lot of literary fiction does not need to do. And that is just such a difficult task. Agatha Christie, how many times did she do it? 66 novels or something. That is just asking like some sort of godlike ability. And television, film, books, they've done such a good job for a century and a half of delivering whodunits that it's really hard to whodunit anyone anymore. It's not even a question. It's like sort of an exclamation point. Because it's just really hard to come up with new strategies. And the reader has become so sophisticated, and they know to suspect the least likely character, that it's really hard to keep it going. But that said, people are doing really amazing work, and I'm trying always to stump myself, which is sort of my litmus test for whether or not it's working.
I love that you referenced Agatha Christie there in her 66 novels. That feels like a very good place to introduce a line from The Man in the Brown Suit, which was an early novel by Christie. But her very knowing heroine, Anne Bedingfield, tells her friend, the society lady, Suzanne Blair, I suspect everybody, And if you've read any detective story, Suzanne, you must know that it's always the most unlikely person who's the villain.
Exactly.
I just love the knowingness of which Christie then, in 1924, was already kind of aware of this trope of the whodunit, that it has to be the least likely person. I don't know if it's hearsay or truth, but I've read that Christie would plot her novels sort of backwards. She'd get to the end, decide who was the least likely villain, and then go back and plant all the sort of clues or the seeds.
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah, I mean, that's so smart because that's how she kind of keeps it fresh. Like, she creates these characters and then she sort of decides at the end. Because sometimes you just don't want it to be like a bookshelf that you have to put together following instructions. So it has to have this element of surprise, I think, to the writer too, in order for it to really deliver. What I find so funny about The Man in the Brown Suit, I know I'm jumping ahead, is that like it's her fourth novel. And for most writers, wow, you've written four novels. I mean, this is just like this very beginning of her career. And so one can see it as like just her still sort of figuring out her career or her art. And this book, I think, and so is The Ministry of Fear, it's plagued with this idea of what fiction already is and what storytelling has already done and what is believable and not believable. I think Green and Christie are both romantics at heart, sort of despairing romantics. But I think also most writers are as well. I mean, I know I am. You write about these, you know, grisly things like murder, but you sort of also are titillated by it. So, I mean, I see the romantic vision or the romantic spirit in both of these writers. And I certainly sort of pick my novels on a similar sort of uncouth sense of romance.
This is a good moment to talk about your fifth novel, The Lost Americans. It's another very elegant, wonderfully twisty thriller, this time set primarily in Cairo, in which your heroine takes on Western arms dealers, a repressive government, and her own family history to figure out the truth behind her brother's mysterious death. How do you start with a novel like that? Is there source material, you know, newspaper clippings, a news report?
Actually, you know what? The real start is twofold. It's, I feel like every book I write is a reaction to the last book I've written. So it's like, oh, I've done that. I want to do something totally different. And I don't want to be a pigeonholed writer in any way whatsoever. Unfortunately, it's hard not to be. But the last two books I wrote, which are very different in their own right, The Destroyers and A Beautiful Crime, were both focused on the sort of world of luxury and privilege and money and wealth and art. One took place on a Greek island. One took place in Venice. It was very much about riches and cafe society. And I don't consider myself sort of a 1% writer. I mean, I'm not from the 1%. And I, you know, I'm fascinated as much with art and geography as I am with politics. And so I just wanted to go in a completely different direction. And so I just felt like this book was a chance for me to write a like grittier story, a more political story, something to get me out of my comfort zones. And Egypt was also the other motivating factor. I've loved Egypt since I was a kid, ancient Egypt, and I've loved Cairo since I visited it in 2010. So I've always wanted to set a book there since I visited, and it just felt like the right moment for it. And so those are the sort of the twofold impulses. And then, yes, as you said, it's really about doing the research, talking to experts, getting them on, you know, a Skype call or the phone. And one of the great things about being a writer is that for the most part, with some rare examples, people are honored and excited to talk about their careers with writers. And they love to tell you, you know, how it actually is. So I've definitely taken advantage of that. And so I spoke with a number of professionals in the arms trade. And then Egypt is another matter altogether that I was researching. And there are scenes cut out that were all about tuning pianos that I, because her boyfriend that she breaks up with at the beginning is also like a piano tuner. And I was, you know, you really go on these crazy, crazy journeys that, you know, never end up in the book. But hopefully it feels like the writer knew.
Well, I think the real skill there is knowing what to leave out as much as what to put in. Because when you have all that knowledge, it's so tempting, perhaps, to show off and say, look, here's what I know about colonial silver, or here's what I know about the international arms trade.
Oh my God, I had chapters about that. Thank God that was removed. No one was interested in that.
I mean, it's the old lesson, show, don't tell, which I think you do extremely well.
There's no sense that we're reading a Wikipedia entry on colonial silver.
Yes, that's the fear. But, you know, I'm not the first person to write about the international arms trade, especially for a thriller. But usually it's from, you know, some very like salty older man who really knows the material. I mean, I'll say like a Jean-Luc Carré. And you just like bombarded with these experts on page one. That's why I liked Kate so much as our guide, because she knows zilch about what her brother does. And I'm no expert. And so I'm learning as Kate's learning, as the reader's learning. You know, so I'm not assuming the reader has any sort of advanced knowledge, because I sure didn't, besides a subscription to The Economist. It really allows you to sort of wander through these unknown worlds by having the protagonist also sort of a dummy.
Right. As you say, the central character of The Lost Americans is Kate Castle. She undertakes this investigation into her brother's mysterious death. You have chosen in all your books not to have a kind of Poirot or Miss Marple type figure. That's obviously deliberate. Why have you chosen not to go down the route of the detective?
I would love to have some sort of staple detective, and you get to meet him, her, they each time. And it's a familiar comfort. But I feel like when an outsider, even a beloved outsider like Miss Marple, comes on the scene, they don't have any personal relationship with the deceased. And so there's no stake for them to figure out what's going on whatsoever. It just becomes a purely an exercise in detection. And I really want the characters in my novel, the main characters of the novel, to feel the urgency of what they have to figure out, or what's wrong, or what happened. And so to me, when there's a detective from the outside or a police investigator, it kind of kills that emotional connection to the death. You lose a lot of what makes it an emotive book. It just really becomes an exercise. So I always try to find a protagonist that has something to lose and is desperate to find something out. And you see this in The Man in the Brown Suit and The Ministry of Fear, which is one reason I picked it, is that these are characters who get embroiled in a larger conspiracy and plot, but they are just ordinary civilians in a way. And so it requires a lot of work to sort of find a way in that, like, why is a normal person involved in, you know, a conspiracy with Germans, or, you know, a diamond smuggling deal gone sour. So it's hard. It's hard to do over and over again. You hope that you make it sort of believable. And that's why, like, for Kate, it's her brother who dies mysteriously in Egypt. It's so far away. And they ruled a suicide. And I was fascinated. One of the reasons I wanted to write this book is I was really fascinated with the idea of it, if a government can be complicit in a murder, or a corporation. Crimes are usually in novels so individual. And also just the fact that when a loved one dies overseas, it's so mercurial. It's so hard to understand where they died, how they died. You can't even visualize it because you don't know the terrain. It's so bureaucratic. You don't get any clear answers. And this idea of justice is even harder from a distance, because you're reliant on laws that are not your own and administrations that aren't interested in you. And so I really wanted the reader to feel that frustration of not knowing. And that's why Kate eventually, of course, has to go to Cairo to just sort of make peace with what happened and try to figure out what happened to her brother. Because it's really devastating. When in Rome doesn't just mean when in Rome eat pasta. It really means like when in Rome you have to follow Roman law and you'll die a Roman death. And so Americans, I think, are a little bit naive in that regard. You feel like Americans are sort of like, we can sort of get away with anything. We can just move around the world and America will protect us somehow. But that's just not the way it is.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest is the author Christopher Bolan. His new novel is The Lost Americans. Chris, you grew up in Cincinnati. How would you describe your childhood there?
I had a really nice childhood. I will tell you that I was a reading fanatic, a bit of a loner. I was an Agatha Christie obsessed child. Is that not creepy? especially in Cincinnati, Ohio, in the 80s. I had Agatha Christie posters on my wall. I had an entire bookshelf reserved for the collection. In fact, The Man in the Brown Suit has that diamond front with a still life. And I had them all in that. That was the preferred covers that I loved so much.
I have to get a picture of the Agatha Christie posters that you had on your wall. What was on these posters? Was it just book covers?
They were from the movies. So I had one that was Death on the Nile, and one was Murder on the Orient Express, the 1970s one. And actually, I was also obsessed with Egypt, as I was saying before. And I think a lot of it had to do with that Death on the Nile poster, which is a beautiful poster of ancient Egypt. And I think that poster, too, I think there was a mini craze for Egypt happening in the 70s because the Tutankhamun exhibition came to New York, and it was a big deal. And so I think the designers of Death on the Nile used that iconography. It was like the 1920s all over again, just like an obsession with Egypt. Agatha Christie, it just fueled my obsession for other places. And what's interesting is The Man in the Brown Suit that we're going to talk about is her fourth book. And I think it was her first one that she set away from England and really sort of adventured out. And so this is like a real moment where she's figuring out how to write about the other places and other worlds. Did I have any friends? I don't know. I can't remember. I think I have really great skin as an adult because I never went outside. I was the opposite of my older sister, who was, you know, by the pool. We didn't have one, a swim club pool, whenever humanly possible. I was desperate to escape Cincinnati as a gay child. I mean, closeted. I wasn't out. I went to a Catholic school. But it was a beautiful place. I mean, it was, you know, it was idyllic in a lot of ways, except socially. But now I go back and I love Cincinnati. It's changed a lot. I've changed a lot.
I wonder if that experience, the closeted child reading Agatha Christie, was in any way instrumental in your decision to write crime novels in which you often center gay characters. For a long time, that simply wasn't typical in genre fiction, although we could talk about the sexual ambiguity of Sherlock Holmes or Poirot. And of course, there was the work of Patricia Highsmith, but in general, there's a sense that audiences are not going to be interested or sympathetic to gay characters in murder mysteries. Is it important for you that your experience as a gay man is reflected in the books you write?
100%. And I do think that there is an obvious and really important link between mysteries and horror and thriller and being gay when you're young. And I think it's like sort of an identification with the monster. I think it's obviously an obsession with secrets and destroying the heterosexual narratives. And I mean, it's all over the place. And also, it's just such an escape. I don't know, for this young generation, they probably have their, it's a totally different world, but growing up in the 80s, books were the ultimate escape for me and like the sort of way out and the see a larger life and also experience gay characters. I quite literally did not know a single out gay man until I left Cincinnati at 18. Not one. I mean, I'm sure that I knew a lot of closeted people and didn't know that they were gay. And obviously I went to Catholic school, so half those priests were, but I didn't have any guidance at all. Like, there wasn't any figure I could point to. And so I remember in high school, I would read D.H. Lawrence because I knew it was bisexual. You know, I would like slog through The Rainbow because there was like a bisexual scene somewhere, or you know what I mean? And I was, so I think books were a tantalizing way to experience life that wasn't shown to me firsthand. And crime, yeah, for sure. I've said it before, but like, you know, every gay novel was a crime novel or is a crime novel, certainly until 20 or 30 years ago, because it was an illegal act in so many ways. And I think that there's a kinship between criminals and at least gay people of my generation. And I just want to add, you're so right about Holmes and Poirot, and the list goes on with detectives. It's like, it's almost like Tiresias, who's like sort of blind and doubly sexual and to be able to like sort of solve the mystery or see so clearly into the human heart, you have to be this sort of liminal figure of questionable identity. And so I think that a lot of mystery writers have used that. Are they gay? Are they straight? They're sort of sitting on a line, makes them a little bit smarter and more mysterious.
And with Poirot, of course, not only is he sort of sexually ambiguous, but he's Belgian. And he's Belgian at a time in Britain when that would have been a kind of quintessential outsider. You know, he's sort of doubly an outsider. He has no sort of sexuality, as it were, but he's also a foreigner. I think most British detectives in fiction were like Sherlock Holmes. They were sort of born in the bone Brits. And then along comes Poirot.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's one of the reasons I don't like those Kenneth Branagh movies, is like they make him so macho. And it's like, you're missing it. Like, he was really a sort of a, like, such a strange bird. Like, it was disarming. That's the whole point of Poirot, is like, he's such a weirdo. And that was so cool that Christie picked that kind of character. I mean, it's so amazing. And you rarely see that today. Like, maybe they have some sort of weird tick, but you never get someone who's really just sort of so outside the system. Mm. But, you know, sometimes you can sense her irritation with Poirot, too.
Right.
Like, he's annoying. and you can feel her being annoyed by him. And that's also great. Like, he's taken on such a life of his own that she, like, kind of can't stand him half the time.
But, you know, I've always felt with Poirot, and we will talk more about this, but there's a way in which Poirot also illuminates the absurdities of the British class system. He's also seeing that world as the outsider. And therefore, we get to see how ridiculous so much of that is and looks. And I don't know if that was deliberate on the part of Christie, but I think far from those people being tropes, she sort of sets us up in a way to, because often it is the sort of, you know, ridiculous titled figure in a Christie novel who turns out to be the scheming master criminal. What else is that but kind of playing on your stereotypes or the prejudices you bring to a book only to have them overturned?
And you're absolutely right. And that's why it just came to me right now, is like, maybe that's why Tommy and Tuppence don't work. They're too sewn into the system.
Right, right. Well, interestingly enough, I thought Anne Bedingfield, who's the heroine of The Man in the Brown Suit, felt a little like a sort of Tommy and Tuppence character in that
yes.
She was pretty straight.
Well, this is where Christie makes a sort of fatal mistake, I think, with this character, is that, and this is what I try not to do, is like, I like a character who's deeply flawed. I mean, so badly flawed, as you can see, like with Kate in The Lost Americans, she is a very flawed person and she has a lot of difficulties and she's hard to get close to. And Christie has made, happens a lot with writers, I think, and also young writers in particular, they make their protagonists too likable. And they obviously have like sort of fallen in love with their own protagonist. I mean, Anne Bedingfield's awesome. She's so much fun. She's great. I want to be Anne Bedingfield. But it's hard to like sort of feel anything's at stake for Anne Bedingfield. I mean, to be fair, like she does risk her entire small amount of money she has left on a ticket, which is awesome.
She's not a character of means at all, which I thought was quite interesting. And I wondered, in fact, if she might be one of the most autobiographical characters in a Christie novel. Christie was worried about money herself. Her father had died when she was younger. She wasn't somebody who came from an impoverished background, but she certainly understood what it was like to have that experience of losing confidence in your means and worrying that her family might not be able to support itself.
I mean, she's obsessed with money, Agatha Christie. In fact, I would be interesting to do a little graph, but most of the plots revolve around money.
Mm.
I mean, that's also like a good way to explain why people kill, but in general. But for Christie, money is an obsession, and not in a negative way. Like she's, you know, a terrible hoarder of money, but I mean, it's on her mind. It's on the minds of the characters. Mm. And so I feel the same way. I always worry about poverty too.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest today is the author, Christopher Bolan. We're talking about two of his favorite books. Chris, we should talk a little more about the plot of The Man in the Brown Suit. Agatha Christie wrote 66 novels, as you pointed out, and a lot of short stories, I think 14 short story collections, all of them still in print, in multiple formats, in dozens of languages. She has her detractors, but she has her surprising champions. One of the interesting rabbit holes I went down in preparation for this program was her popularity in France. I hadn't realized she was so revered there. Her books sell four times as many copies as they do in Britain. Roland Barthes and more recently Michel Houellebecq, if I'm pronouncing that right, were avid fans. I think Houellebecq thinks she's one of the great writers of the 20th century. That was a real corrective to my sense of slight sheepishness in admitting how much I've always loved Christie. You know, I think I come from a world, from the UK, where there's a good deal of snobbery around Agatha Christie. So their enthusiasm, and actually your enthusiasm, made me feel rather better about my own enthusiasm.
I love the snobbery against her because it is, I don't know how this works, but she is the most best-selling novelist ever, I think. Mm-hmm. And yet when you love her so much, you feel like you're a member of a very small community. And that is bizarre because every single person's read her. And yet to be obsessed with her, I think, is like a very special, strange little club.
You told us that you started reading Christie as a child. Do you remember your earliest encounter? What was the book that turned you onto her?
Well, I come from a very long line of mystery readers. My grandmother was obsessed with Agatha Christie, as well as a number of other writers, Dorothy L. Sayers. My mom was a big mystery reader, and I picked up the mantle, I think, in about fourth grade. But I can't remember my first one, but I remember reading a few of them so specifically, I can tell you exactly where I was. I remember the first time reading And Then There Were None, 10 Little Indians. Mm. I was sitting in the living room. The day was setting. It was turning to night. And I remember as the room darkened, suddenly just being halfway through the book and so terrified by it. And like, so sort of like amazed and terrified by it. And I couldn't stop reading it. And yet I was so scared because the voices were changing. You didn't know who the killer was, which was such a new phenomenon to me. And it must have been such a new phenomenon when it was being read for the first time. And I will never forget that feeling, which was just like, this book is magical. And I can't believe this is happening. I was so engrossed in it. It's never left me.
Of course, And Then There Were None or 10 Little Indians is among Christie's most popular and successful of novels, up there with the Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
Oh, absolutely. She deserves to get credit for every single horror movie from the 70s onward, or like, you know, even like the game shows where people like one by one get kicked off an island. I mean, I think all of this comes back to And Then There Were None. It's amazing.
You've chosen a much lesser known title, The Man in the Brown Suit, which, as we said earlier, sits somewhere between a murder mystery and a thriller, though it's definitely a whodunit. And it features a young, self-described adventuress, Anne Bedingfield, who just happens to be in the right place at the wrong time. Or maybe that's the right time, depending on your point of view. She witnesses a man fall to the tracks of a London tube station. A doctor who examines the man on sight pronounces him dead and then drops a note that sets Anne Bedingfield off on a twisty adventure all the way to South Africa on the trail of a killer, missing diamonds, and, as it turns out, a hot new lover. Chris, what was it about this novel, given the extensive Christie canon, that appealed to you so much?
You know, a lot of people don't like when Christie steers away from Poirot and Marple. But I remember loving this book, and I remember loving They Came to Baghdad, which is a similar setup of a kind of a woman on her own in a foreign clime, trying to solve a mystery that's bigger than herself. But, you know, I want to take back something I said earlier that maybe Anne Bedingfeld's too likable and easy. She's such a contemporary character with some obvious obvious faults for that time. But I was surprised by the tone and the sharpness and the freshness of her observations. And maybe in 1924, a woman jumping out on her own and running off, spending all of her money to go on a cruise alone to Africa is really radical.
Hmm. Yeah, I was struck by the fact that this book was published 4 years before women in the UK received the right to vote on the same terms as men. And yet you have this right. adventuress, Anne Bedingfeld, when Suzanne, her friend, suggests they turn to Colonel Race for advice. She responds, "I objected vigorously to this unsporting proposal. I recognized in it the disastrous effects of matrimony." How often have I not heard a perfectly intelligent female say in the tone of one clinching an argument, "Edgar says," and all the time you are perfectly aware that Edgar is a perfect fool.
That's so good.
We're 100 years on from this book, and there are probably still lots of people who would defer to the man in the room or the husband. But here's Agatha Christie sort of calling out that behavior. At the same time, there is a turn in this book towards the end when Anne falls head over heels in love with a pretty unreconstructed male who carries her over his shoulder in a kind of Tarzan and Jane parody that I thought was super left field given the first half of this novel.
This novel has like sort of, it starts out so well. And then, I mean, and I love where she goes with it in a lot of ways, but then there are certain moments at the end where you're like, oh God, don't say that. And it's a lot of like, yeah, it feels like it's moving backward against feminism, or it's just a weird intrusion of, so women like to be subservient to a strong man and they want a man who tells them what to do. And yeah, this didn't age well.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the author Christopher Bolan. We're talking about Agatha Christie's 1924 novel, The Man in the Brown Suit. Christopher, one of the things that I was extremely conscious of as I read The Man in the Brown Suit was the proximity of the First World War to the writing of the book, just 5 years, really, which is nothing. Christie had worked as a nurse during the war and seen her fair share of traumatic injuries, I'm sure. But I think she also understood that after such a grotesque war, that nothing would be the same, and that the sort of pre-war certainties, the class distinctions, the old kind of confidence in Britain and empire, that all those things would collapse. And, and in a way, I think what makes her books so interesting is so many of them do take place between the First and Second World War. And, you know, her great theme seems to be the unreliability of things, the sense that the ground is shifting beneath your feet. And the murders are really a way of exploring all of that chaos.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that what we're seeing is a sort of a crumbling empire. And, you know, and suddenly there's all of this conspiracy and thievery in it. And the colonel, as he's called, who's the sort of mastermind that we're looking for in the book, who is the real killer, is taking advantage of the power of being, you know, a British citizen in a world that is changing rapidly and just trying to make an obscene amount of money off of it through the criminal activity. And so I do think that Christie's tracing that fall from the heights and assuredness and that feeling of owning the world to something, you know, much more devious. And I also find it very interesting that she was still married to her first husband when she wrote this book. I think that they didn't get a divorce until 2 years later in 1926. And then she married an archaeologist as her second husband. And yet we can see here that she's already really fascinated with archaeology and that whole sort of British science. So I think a lot of times we think that, oh, Christy started to write about other places because of Max, her second husband, and his job. But we could see she has a real fascination with going on well beyond the UK, even at this time. I mean, there's a riot at the end of this book, a political riot in South Africa. Mm. And the British are trying to flee, and there's a chance that they'll, you know, get caught up in it. Mm. So I think she is sensing those dangers. You know, she could have easily just stayed in the British countryside, but I think this is like a book where she's really trying to make sense of the larger world and see the place of England in it.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, the novelist Christopher Bolan. His latest book is The Lost Americans. We'll be back to talk more about Agatha Christie and Graham Greene after this. Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, letting you know that this month on Radio Catskill, we'll be taking a look back at the biggest local news stories of the year and showcasing the work of our amazing news team. Look, I've been here for decades and I've never seen anything like 2025. We had more reporters making more quality news than ever before, and none of that would have been possible without you. Another thing that I never saw before this year? 24% of our budget disappearing overnight. You know, the defunding of public media was a shock. It continues to threaten the good work that we do, but it has not stopped that work. And again, that's thanks to listeners like you who stood with us. I thank you so much for that. And I ask that you stand with us again. We're trying to make our year-end goal, and right now, your donation will have triple the impact. From now until December 31st, gifts of $1,000 or less will be matched one-to-one by Newsmatch and by an anonymous longtime Radio Catskill supporter. You make a one-time donation before the end of the year, it will be tripled. Become a sound supporter, all 12 of your monthly donations will be tripled. Plus, gifts of $100 and more will also be entered for a chance to win a two-night stay at the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast. A renovated farmhouse sleeps four, located near the top of Hoke Mountain Road in the town of Walton. Go to WJFFradio.org, WJFFradio.org to give today. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Supported by listeners like you. Thank you so much.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we've got the exotic sounds of the Waitiki 7 and the new Les Baxter Orchestra. Plus, the Brass Impact Orchestra will take you to the very threshold of pain. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest for this episode is the author, Christopher Bolan. We're talking about Agatha Christie's The Man in the Brown Suit and Graham Greene's The Ministry of Fear. Chris, we're all familiar with the so-called Blitz spirit of London. But in Graham Greene's The Ministry of Fear, the Blitz is actually a terrifying backdrop for a kind of twisty cat and mouse game in which a chance visit to a street fair throws the book's protagonist, Arthur Rowe, into the center of a sinister Nazi plot. Now, much like The Man in the Brown Suit, this is not one of Graham Greene's best-known novels, and Greene himself described it as one of his entertainments. Why is it the book you've chosen to discuss today?
Well, it's a little bit like The Man in the Brown Suit in that the central character sort of stumbles into a plot and follows it, you know, and doggedly refuses to let it go. I chose this book for a very different reason. The plot is amazing, and it's a really fun suspense read, but I actually find that it's Graham Greene's meditation on what's happening in London and the changing world of Britain and global war to be just so devastating to read. And so there's something about the loss and the surrealism of what's happening all around this man as the suspense novel goes on that is the most beautiful and tragic description of war and the changing world that I've ever encountered. I mean, I'm just blown away by some of these passages. Mm-hmm. And it's baked into a really interesting, you know, suspense story. So you can read it on two levels at the same time.
This is an apt moment to get a flavor of the novel, and you've chosen a section to read today. Do you have it handy?
Yes, I have it here. And I just want to say that this is a sort of prelude chapter. He's dreaming. He's in the raid shelters and he's dreaming. And we should say that Arthur Rowe starts out, he wanders into this charity fete, and he's already been in prison for killing his wife. But it was a mercy killing because she was sick. But, you know, he was sort of euthanasia. So that's important to know. So he's dreaming. Mother, please listen to me. But he suddenly realized that he was a child. He's in the dream. So how could he make her believe? He was not yet 8 years old. He could see the nursery window on the second floor with the bars across. And presently, the old nurse would put her face to the glass and signal to him to come in. Mother, he said, I've killed my wife and the police want me. His mother smiled and shook her head and said, my little boy, you couldn't kill anyone. Time was short. For the other end of a long, peaceful lawn, beyond the croquet hoops and out the shadow of the great Solomon pine, came the vicar's wife carrying a basket of apples. Before she could reach him, he must convince his mother. But he had only childish words. I have. His mother leaned back, smiling in the deck chair, and said, my little boy, you wouldn't hurt a beetle. It was a way she had always to get the conventional phrase just wrong. But that's why, he said, that's why. And his mother waved to the vicar's wife and said, it's a dream, dear, a nasty dream. He woke up in the dim, lurid underground place. Somebody had tied a red silk scarf over the bare globe to shield it. All along the walls, the bodies lay too deep, while outside the raid rumbled and receded. This was a quiet night. Any raid which happened a mile away wasn't a raid at all. An old man snored across the aisle, and at the end of the shelter, two lovers lay on a mattress with their hands and knees touching. Roe thought, this would be a dream too to her. She wouldn't believe it. She had died before the First Great War, when aeroplanes, strange crates of wood, just staggered across the channel. She could no more have imagined this than her small son in his brown corduroy knickers and his blue jersey with his pale, serious face. He could see himself like a stranger in the yellowing snapshot of her album. She'd grow to be a murderer. Lying on his back, he caught the dream and held it, pushed the vicar's wife back into the shadows of the pine, and argued with his mother. This isn't real life anymore, he said. Tea on the lawn, evening song, croquet, the old ladies calling, the gentle, unmalicious gossip, the gardener trundling the wheelbarrow full of leaves and grass. People write about it as if it still went on. Lady novelists describe it over and over again in books of the month. But it's not there anymore. His mother smiled at him in a scared way, but let him talk. He was the master of the dream now. He said, I'm wanted for murder I didn't do. People want to kill me because I know too much. I'm hiding underground, and up above, the Germans are methodically smashing London to bits all around me. You remember St. Clement's, the bells of St. Clement's? They've smashed that. St. James, Piccadilly, the Burlington Arcade, Garland's Hotel, where we stayed for the pantomime, Maples and John Lewis. It sounds like a thriller, doesn't it? But the thrillers are like life, more like life than you are. This lawn, your sandwiches, that pine. You used to laugh at the books Miss Savage read about spies and murders and violence and wild motor car chases, but dear, that's real life. It's what we've all made of the world since you've died. I just think that is so amazing, where he's trying to communicate the insanity that is reality to someone who just wouldn't believe it.
I think the tremendous victory of this novel, or the tremendous success of this novel, is that it's able to balance that kind of writing, that kind of psychological acuity, with this page-turning thriller in which there is very little slack. The story moves at a tremendous pace. Lots of things happen.
I mean, it's very funny, too, in moments. It has that very, like, black humor of death.
It really does. And also, I think, like Agatha Christie, it's clear that he's drawing on real experience. Graham Greene was an air raid warden in London during the Blitz, and actually right through the thick of it.
It has the surrealism and realism. And I think the only other book I can think of that does that just as well is Slaughterhouse-Five.
Mm.
And that was the destruction of Dresden. And the weird thing is he describes it so well, but he also describes it with such, the destruction with such beauty too. He talks about how, you know, whole houses can now be seen, the inside seen in the wallpaper, and like, you know, half a house exists, and that London used to be a big city, but now it's just because of the bombing, it's just a series of small towns.
Right.
It's so terrifying and so beautiful at the same time. I mean, and he does that so well, and it's frightening because of that.
One of the questions I often have about Greene is his attitude to his own life. I get a sense that he was often ambivalent about living. He famously undertook multiple suicide attempts when he was younger, and when his own house in Clapham was destroyed in 1940 by a bomb, he almost treated it as a relief. He wrote, "It's sad because it was a pretty house, but oddly enough, it leaves me feeling very carefree." He seemed to have a kind of come what may attitude to living. Do you think that attitude to life is also what makes his literature, his fiction work?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that he's one of those great writers that writes so well about hopelessness. In fact, I find often the weakness of Greene is when he gets too Catholic. And those are his serious novels. I mean, to him, according to him, is his Catholic novels, really. And I find like that's when it starts to become... That's why I like the entertainment so much, is he's willing to take risks. He's willing to be funny, but he's so dark at the same time. And he sort of embraces the absurdity of life and the ways in which we try to hold on to any sort of structures or normalcy or patterns amid just complete madness. And I think that those entertainments, he really lets himself kind of go in that direction. And I think that's a reflection of who he was as a person, which is adrift and lost. You know, he was a difficult person. He was a philanderer. I mean, you know, he had kids that he never saw. He was a Rolling Stone in so many ways, and hard to know. But yeah, that certainly made him like such a deliciously smart writer. And he would just, he would take things in such bleak directions and really just sort of go in the extreme. I mean, I find this novel surprisingly postmodern and experimental, especially in just in the way you said, like, whoa, like he just had built a whole character in the first part and then blows the mind out. And now he becomes like a totally different person because he's suffering from amnesia.
Right, right. There's almost a kind of Kafka-esque quality.
Yeah, completely.
He also said that any novelist has something in common with a spy. He watches, he overhears, he seeks motives and analyzes character. And in his attempt to serve literature, he is unscrupulous. Does that tally with your experience as a writer?
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, who knows if Graham Greene was gay? I mean, he seems like he was pretty heterosexual. But I feel like there is a bit of a observer from the outside to writers. I always think that's enhanced by being gay because you're always trying to, at least, of course, of our generation, when you had to be closeted, like you had to pretend, you had to hide, you had to cover your tracks, you had to have two selves and two faces. And so I think that there is a bit of that with writers too. You know, you're watching things, you're using people for material, you're kind of covering your own tracks, trying to think of ways out. I mean, plot-wise, all you're doing is trying to think of like ways out, especially for crime writing, obviously.
I read in a 1979 interview that Greene had with The New Yorker that he experienced this, in quotes, leaden weight after the completion of a book, this sort of hollowness, I guess. That's not the first time I've come across writers who experience a kind of...
like a postpartum depression.
Postpartum depression. I wonder how you deal with that.
One of the good things about so many rounds of edits is that you get so sick of the book by the last edit. Like a year later, you're like rewriting a scene and you're like, okay, I I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm so tired of this book. So that's a savior, because you're almost glad that it's out of your hands. But I find the postpartum depression comes once it's published. Mm-hmm. Because then it's like, oh, you look forward to it. It's going to come out in the future. You've done something, but it's not yet there. And then it does come out and you feel like, oh, God, what have I done? And like, what is there now except the blank page again? I mean, it's very sorrowful. Mm-hmm. I feel like a release of a book. I know that sounds so stupid because it's I feel so lucky to be published. But it feels like a loss.
You said that Green's Catholic novels are less successful for you. But there is a degree of Catholicism in this book too, The Ministry of Fear.
Uh-huh.
I find it evident in Roe describing himself as a murderer for the assisted suicide of his wife.
Yes. Roe was a murderer the way other men are poets. I love that.
Green's characters often think of themselves as sinners. Is that concept harder for readers to grasp today, I wonder, than it would have been for Green's peers?
Probably, in a way. I mean, I grew up Catholic, so I have a huge sense of guilt embedded in me from early on, so I get that. And yet, to be fair, okay, Arthur Roe is actually a good person, and that is not debatable. He's actually very noble. A lot of Green's other characters, I'm thinking of the character in End of the Affair or The Quiet American, are not so admirable. I mean, they're also rather vicious and they're selfish. And I mean, there is a lot of Catholic in that, but then there's the other side of the Catholic too, where it's like you can be bad and then you can ask for forgiveness at the end. And you're absolved. So, I mean, this is a particular character where the guilt is very extreme. And you're right, that is very Catholic. But I think that he also does a lot of the opposite, where he kind of creates these little devils in his character. So, yeah, I think that there's two dual, like most Catholics, there's two dueling angel-devil scenarios going on. I don't like when he gets too preachy, which is like the power of the glory, because there's not enough play.
Chris, you've given us great insights into two among your favorite books. I wonder if we can close with a sense of what you have take from each of these writers, Agatha Christie and Graham Greene, as inspiration for your own writing.
Well, that's such a nice question, because if I could create a book that I want to read more than anything else, it would be an Agatha Christie Graham Greene fusion. I think she was a fan of him, and I think he might have been a fan of her. And I know they have some sort of correspondence, I think maybe very small, but I want Agatha Christie's brilliant plotting. I'm not even going to ask for her long career, because I don't think I have that in me, but I want her genius plotting abilities, and I want Graham Greene's soul and depth.
Mm.
You know, that's what I take from both of them. And I think if you could fuse them, it would just be this masterwork.
Christopher Boland, thank you so much for being my guest on this episode of Shelf Life.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciated it. It was fun being here.
We've been talking about The Man in the Brown Suit by Agatha Christie, now in the public domain and so available from multiple publishers, and The Ministry of Fear by Graham Greene, published by Penguin. Christopher Boland's new book, The Lost Americans, is published by HarperCollins. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in collaboration with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify, including episodes with Brooke Gladstone on a madcap Russian classic, Alan Cumming on A Turbulent Night with Gore Vidal, and Jonathan Nascoffrey on the short stories of Dennis Johnson. And you've heard this before, but please give us a review and a 5-star rating. It helps others find the show.
Sullivan County's social host law, Jared's Law, makes it illegal for anyone 18 or older to provide alcohol or cannabis to minors. Named for a local teen killed in a drunk driving accident, Jared's Law ensures that adults are held accountable, with penalties including fines and even jail time. Parents and guardians are still the number one deterrent to underage substance use, and Jared's Law helps keep our kids safe. Paid for by Catholic Charities.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Padma Lakshmi, television host and cookbook author. She'll talk with comedian W. Kamau Bell about her newest book, Padma's All-American, Tales, Travels, and Recipes from Taste the Nation and Beyond. And she'll try out some of her own comedy material. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.